And I'm from the south side of Chicago, man. In the 30s, man, and during the Depression, are you kidding? We lost my mother when I was 7, and my brother and I, we were like these street rats, you know. I wanted to be a gangster till I was 11.
Wow.
You want to be what you see.
Right.
And that's all we ever saw.
You may know that Quincy Jones is one of the most accomplished musicians and producers of all time, but there's probably a lot about him you don't know. On this special New Year's Eve edition of Press Play, we'll listen back to some of our favorite music-themed interviews of 2018, including my conversation with Quincy and his daughter, Rashida Jones. First, though, my conversation with another musical genius, L.A. Phil violinist Vijay Gupta. He was named a MacArthur Genius this year, an award given to people who show exceptional creativity in their work. Vijay Gupta is known for launching Street Symphony. It's a nonprofit that brings classical music to Skid Row, to homeless shelters, and the L.A. County Jail. For most people, getting the MacArthur is an achievement of a lifetime. And Vijay is only 31 years old. When I spoke with him back in October, I began by asking him what the award means to him.
In some strange way, it's with the secret nomination process, so many people must have been nominators. Therefore, it's almost this kind of like secret army of people who trusted and believed in me for years.
Mm-hmm.
And that now this is like an investment of trust for me to like be all of who I am. So everything is on the table in terms of questions. You know, and it also came at a time in my life where there's a really serious like relationship life transition happening for me. And so it's like that had already happened.
Are you getting married?
I was getting divorced.
Oh.
And so and like leaving a, like a 5-year long relationship. That sort of like the pain of that transition already brought up all the questions of like identity and like existential questions and spiritual questions and relational questions and like, what does it mean to live here in LA? Like, what? Where's home? All those questions happen, and then this thing happens, you know, and it's like everything's on the table, you know. Mm-hmm. So it's a really like vulnerable time,
yeah,
you know, and yet to be given as much trust and faith and belief. It's overwhelming.
It must be.
Yeah.
Where are you from?
I grew up in Mid-Hudson Valley, New York. I was born in Nyack on the mm-hmm. Hudson. And then my parents were immigrants from India. They came to Queens in the 1970s and they kept moving further and further upstate. My dad was a travel agent. And I grew up near Poughkeepsie. Yeah, it was an odd place to grow up because we were like the only brown family for like pretty serious 15-20 mile radius, and not only brown but like South Asian, Desi, you know, Indian.
Yeah,
that was odd.
Was it traumatic?
It certainly was in ways, because I learned how to cope with never being fully seen from a very, very young age. And certainly along with not being seen as a different race and all that came with it, I also wasn't seen for being really talented at playing the violin. So I started playing when I was 4. But a lot of my local music teachers either said, we can't handle him, or said, you need to go to New York City. Like, if you want to like actually like cultivate this talent. And so there was, you know, so much of what my parents were coping with and dealing with, which was all about living their lives through me. And like putting me in front of people, and like my dad was obsessed with Oprah, so like I was on Oprah when I was 7, and like he wrote to Oprah on my behalf, like using my name and everything.
Like pretending you were writing?
Yes, that's right. Yeah,
like as a 7-year-old.
As a 7-year-old, I wrote a typewritten letter to Oprah.
I think maybe she probably saw through that. I don't know.
Oh, absolutely. You know, and like the whole, I mean, like, but when I was 7 or 8, like we had this whole, you know, camera crew from Harpo camped out on our front lawn in upstate New York.
Well, so you were seen for sure.
And I was seen for, as certainly. And that's the weird thing I'm grappling with now, which is like I was always seen as the prodigy, quote unquote mm-hmm. prodigy, and seen as being this really bright, shiny person. But as a result, I was never allowed to be angry. I was never allowed to be sad. I was never allowed to be tired. You know, I had to be on. So I learned how to be on. I made my whole life out of that. And that's even a question now. What does it mean to actually begin to take care of myself for the first time?
Wow. And maybe step away from the limelight a little bit.
That also has been shifting and changing as I've become involved in the work of Street Symphony. because there was a very real part of me that felt more seen and witnessed for the real stuff I was feeling being in Skid Row. You know, I would go into Skid Row and have like a whole program planned out, and there'd be folks sitting in a shelter or a clinic and said, we're not doing that today because we can see you're hurting. What's going on?
Really?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. I mean, they're my mentors and friends and caretakers and family, you know, even when like I was losing family.
What do you mean losing family?
So I was actually disowned by my parents.
When
I met my ex-wife, because she happened to be a white woman, and my parents were not happy about me dating someone who was not South Asian or Indian. And it was a control thing. You know, it was like really the first true love of my life. And they flipped out, totally flipped out. And it was traumatic, and there was a lawsuit, and it was just awful, 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 awful. And so like between like my LA Phil colleagues and folks in Skid Row, I realized that like I've always had family, like their family,
mm-hmm.
you know, in a very, mm-hmm. very real grounded sense. And so there's almost this invitation that I get to actually take now into my life of like the Skid Row community and friends of mine saying, you need to take care of yourself. Like, what does that look like for you? And now I'm actually asking those questions, and it's terrifying.
Because now you are no longer with your wife,
yeah.
divorced,
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
and that just happened.
Yeah.
And you have this award, and you're being interviewed all over the place. It's like the Oprah thing.
Yeah.
This show is just like Oprah. I'm just saying.
Perfect. Can't wait. Can't wait.
But in a way, I mean, so you're experiencing that again. And
yeah.
And so it's maybe bringing up similar issues.
Yes. And also the reality of how I get to choose, maybe. For the first time in my life, how things are different. You know, that to
me is
very
real. Did you feel you had no choice since you were 4 years old?
The choice was very narrowly relegated to like a very specific window. You know, it's like choose to practice and be great, you know, or choose to have some pretty serious issues. And the choice was never extended to me to choose how to be excellent. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
And that also got replicated in just the system of classical music, too. Like, in the conservatory world, or you take an audition, there's a very narrow window to the, like, 0.1% of how you place your finger on the string of whether you win an audition or not. Like, there have been people who I've heard in audition rounds just, like, miss something narrowly, and colleagues click the button and be like, I'm done listening. And not just because it's the LA Phil, but just because you have this standard of excellence that it's really not yours. It's a construct. And so, like, to actually get to choose how I want to be excellent in the world is, like, a pretty daunting gift. It's daunting because, like, I get to make the rules, you know, in my own way.
And is that one of the reasons why you started Street Symphony?
To a certain extent, yes. I mean, so much of the definition of Street Symphony has shifted and changed. But I feel like the most honest way I could respond to seeing the horror of Skid Row for the first time, to what felt like someone literally punching me in the gut, was to make music there. You know, and I had a background in science. I started going to college when I was 13. That wasn't my choice. I had an undergrad in bio pre-med when I was 17. And I actually genuinely did fall in love with science. And I fell in love with both neuroscience and with the idea of being a doctor like Paul Farmer, that Doctor Beyond Borders kind of doctor.
He was in Haiti, did a lot of work in Haiti for
That's
for
right.
Many years.
Yeah. Worked with MRSA, worked mm-hmm. with people who were with, you know, HIV AIDS, and doing serious public health work, Haiti, Ethiopia. I wanted to be that kind of doctor. And then I was lucky enough to win a job in the LA Phil, and I saw Skid Row for the first time. And to be very honest with you, I felt like a hypocrite. I was doing something that was easy for me and that I loved doing. And that if the world really needed a doctor, that doctor didn't need to be in Haiti or Ethiopia. Public health works are needed in Skid Row.
Right.
So it was like, well, what on earth does the world need with another violinist? I should have been a doctor. So it was this kind of existential crisis that happened. And then I met Nathaniel Ayers, who was the subject of a book and a movie called The Soloist.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And so Nathaniel was that mirror to me, because here was a musician who was ridiculously talented to the level of deserving to be on any concert hall stage in the world. But because he experienced homelessness, because undoubtedly he was black, because he had a mental illness, here was a man who lived in the Second Street tunnel for 20 years. I couldn't comprehend that.
You both went to Juilliard.
Yeah.
Not at the same time, obviously. But yeah. Do you see yourself as, that could have been me?
That was a real question. I mean, yes, I have a tremendous amount of privilege. I got to study at a place like Juilliard. I always had a safety net. But there were musicians and colleagues and students who were going to school with me who I don't know where they are right now. You know, I know they had a really, really hard time grappling with serious mental health issues when they were at school. So I don't know how many more Nathaniels are out there, but they're out there.
Is there a connection, do you think, between mental illness and musical prodigies?
You know, I come back to this idea of whose version of excellence is it? Because the pressure and the competition of being at conservatory is so devastating, because in a sense, we had to shut down a part of our humanity in order to adhere to that standard of excellence that was not ours. It actually wasn't about being creative at conservatory. It was about doing things the right way. And I could imagine for someone like Nathaniel, and certainly for me as someone who's certainly struggled with depression in my life, to have that kind of pressure instituted and saying that if you don't do this, you're going to fail. That's crushing. That's pathological. And then we have entire systems that are built and propagated upon that. So, you know, going to be in Skid Row, we have an amazing composer in residence as part of Street Symphony, and her name is Rena Esmail. And she says that for folks in Skid Row, music and art is not a form of entertainment. It's a lifeline. And we see that being very much the truth, because there are so many artistic, resilient, brave people who live in Skid Row who have experienced the pathology and trauma and stigma. And yet they're some of the most resilient people in the world. And I believe that they are, because they have access to their own creative and expressive voice. Mm.
Is Rena Esmail creating works for musicians on Skid Row?
Yeah, she is. And she actually created a really amazing piece of music called Take What You Need. This is a piece that was premiered 2 years ago at a project of Street Symphony called the Messiah Project, which is a sing-along performance of Handel's Messiah in Skid Row. And so we commissioned this piece from Rena to actually be a piece that not only told the story of people impacted by homelessness, but also engaged the entire audience. So the piece is a sing-along. And so the audience sings back to the performers who sing back to the audience. And then there are three interludes where someone from the audience can come up and tell their story. So we workshopped the piece in county jails and shelters and clinics all over LA. And we went to the Women's County Jail in Compton, the Linwood Jail. And we asked a question during the interlude section, which was, while you're here, what keeps you going? And women would say the names of their children or their partners or their loved ones into this space. And it was literally that Rena had created a musical sanctuary through her music.
That
and that's very much the way that we think about music.
You have brought your violin.
Mm-hmm.
And will you play a little piece?
Would love to.
Of hers?
I'll play an excerpt from Rena Esmail's piece, Take What You Need.
Thank you.
was beautiful. Thank you for playing that for us. Thank you for bringing that to us. I could see how emotional you were playing that. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Well, Rina actually wrote that arrangement for me after my father passed away. It was the beginning of 2017. And I can't help playing that piece thinking about her, but also thinking about my dad. And my dad was an immigrant from West Bengal in India. And he was actually undocumented when he came to the United States. He was 23 years old. And he worked, you know, peeling potatoes in kitchens in New York City and worked baggage claim at JFK. And my mom, who he was married to, was 17 at the time. And they had a really hard time. And yet my dad was, you know, if you have this idea of the American dream construct, he did it. I mean, my dad started this travel agency from scratch to the point where he sent both of his sons to Juilliard, you know. And he was one of the most artistic, charming, erudite, elegant people I knew. And it was his dream to put me in front of some of the greatest musicians in the world. So, he, you know, he wrote that letter to Oprah, but he also wrote to Yehudi Menuhin. He wrote to Zubin Mehta. And eventually, he stalked Zubin Mehta all over Europe when he was the conductor of the New York Philharmonic. It was like pre-Google, 1995. My dad kind of figured out where Mehta was staying with the New York Phil, to the point where he got me to play an audition for Zubin Mehta when I was 9 in Tel Aviv. And I'll never forget, my dad actually sat out in the hall during my audition. You know, he didn't wait for me backstage because he wanted to see Mehta's reaction. And that to me now is very telling because there was so much on the line for him. And I realized that it wasn't even that he was living vicariously through me. I was his life. Mm-hmm. And that's loaded.
Mm-hmm.
That has
a lot of responsibility
of stuff. Yeah,
for a
9-year-old. And that, I mean, that was my life, you know. And when I got the job in the LA Phil, my dad actually told a lot of his friends back home that I got a job working at Disney Corporation, not Walt Disney Concert Hall, because that way his friends would be more impressed. So, you know, go back to being enough.
Mm-hmm.
And what that actually means. And he kind of chased that wound his whole life.
Wow.
So that's why that piece is emotional for me.
Gosh, that's really intense. So he was pretty young when he died.
I was in his mid-60s.
Yeah. And is your mom still alive?
Mm-hmm.
And what does she think of your award?
We've only had one email go back and forth. I know that she's proud. We haven't talked in a couple of years. So actually letting her know that I was grateful for her is one of the first times I reached out in the last couple of years.
So you reached out after you won the award to
mm-hmm.
her?
Mm-hmm. About 20 minutes before the announcement. I sent her and my brother an email just saying, I know I wouldn't be here without you.
Oh, wow. I wonder if you could play another song for us.
Sure. Happy to. Here's some Bach. Thank you.
Betts MacArthur Genius winner and LA Phil violinist Vijay Gupta. Coming up, Quincy Jones talks about his rough upbringing and his numerous health scares.
Were you working too hard?
No, I'll never admit.
See, he still won't admit it.
Indulging is what got me in trouble.
My interview with the music legend and his daughter, Rashida Jones, next on Press Play. This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. Sounds cool musically. It's likely Quincy Jones had a hand in it. Quincy Jones has made so much music in his life, it's kind of hard to grasp it all. He's 85 years old now. And to put a bow on his career, his daughter, the actress Rashida Jones, has made a documentary about her dad. It's called Quincy. I went to the Four Seasons to talk to them about it. He's not really up for trotting around the city doing interviews. He's had a couple of serious health scares recently, including a stroke. Rashida's sitting in a chair next to him. She keeps a gentle and vigilant eye over him. It's obvious they're really close because he let her do the film really without any conditions.
Only I just said yes and turned it over to them. I didn't start this.
He said yes.
He said yes. You wanted to make the movie.
Yes. He does have a quality of connection with people that I just have never found with anybody else, where it can be an hour, it can be 5 minutes, and it's this transcendent experience where for some reason you read people, you see people, you kind of get into their bones. and we wanted to try to capture that.
So happy you're here, man.
I'm here, I'm ready to do the thing. You called and I came, man.
Love you, man. Hey, baby. How you doing, man? So proud of you, man.
And also share the scope, you know, the large scope, the impressive large scope of his accomplishments in the world and how those two things are connected.
The accomplishments. Well, there's this song, his first hit single in 1963. In the decades since, Quincy has composed, produced, or played on so many albums, it's hard to keep count. A record 79 Grammy Award nominations, 27 wins. He's one of only a few EGOTs, someone who's won an Emmy, Grammy, Oscar, and Tony. Quincy's worked with everyone. Ray Charles when he was just 14, Ella Fitzgerald, Dinah Washington, Frank Sinatra, Chaka Khan, Miles Davis, the list goes on. And, of course, Michael. So tonight, you're leaving my five upon the shelf. And just enjoy yourself. It's gone. Ooh, let the madness in the music get to you. Like this so bad at all. Quincy produced Michael Jackson's Off the Wall in 1979.
We tried all kinds of things I'd learned over the years to help him with his artistic growth. Things like dropping keys just a minor third to give him more flexibility and a more mature range. He was so shy, sometimes he'd sit down and sing behind the couch with his back to me.
That album made Michael, established him as a solo artist. He wasn't really known as an adult performer until then, just the child star of the Jackson 5. Then, 3 years later, Quincy produced Thriller. Okay, I'm pretty sure you already knew most of that if you know anything about Quincy Jones. But what you probably don't know much about, but get a window into in his daughter's documentary, is his personal life and how he grew up. In 1930s Chicago, he says his family was so poor, sometimes they would eat rats. As Quincy likes to say, it was no joke.
The 30s was a depression.
And that you were running with
by
gangsters
ourselves.
And you didn't really have a mom because she was in a mental hospital.
Yep.
And that seems to have been difficult for you
your entire life. Sticks.
And do you think about her now?
Pardon?
Do you think about her today often?
Every now and then, but it wasn't a positive experience, you know. Mm-hmm. Until she left her, she was always in my case.
His mom had schizophrenia. He grew up on the streets. In the documentary, he says that when he was 7, he was stabbed in his hand.
You see that right there? I went on the wrong street, and they took a switchblade and nailed my hand to a fence, man.
What?
7 years old. See this one here?
Yeah.
It's an ice pick, man.
Wow.
Yeah, I wanted to be a gangster till I was 11, because that's all I saw. And I found that piano, and the next day I was going to Robert E. Koontz Junior High in Bremerton. So the sousaphone, tuba, B-flat, baritone, E-flat, alto, French horn, trombone, so we could play with the majorettes and the marching band, and trumpet. That's why I love the Right for Brass, because I played all of them. So I learned from the best, honey. And I learned very early in life why God gave us 2 ears and 1 mouth. You're supposed to listen twice as much as you talk. 2 ears, 1 mouth. And I knew when to shut up when somebody knew what they're talking about. I did.
Who is your greatest teacher?
Hmm?
Who is your greatest teacher?
Ray Charles, Benny Carter, Clark Terry, Count Basie, Duke Ellington, all of them. Basie. They put me on the shorts when I was young.
Aside from playing all those instruments, Quincy Jones discovered he had a gift for arranging. When he was just 29 years old, he was arranging and conducting music for Frank Sinatra, who was in his 50s.
I would like to have you meet a gentleman who's been doing these marvelous orchestrations for me, Mr. Quincy Jones. Right there. Thank you, Mr. Quincy Jones. One of the bright young stars in the orchestrating business. Q, go ahead.
Quincy would bring that hard swing to Sinatra's cool.
Quincy's drive is what made the difference in the recordings that I began to do. The orchestra drove harder than it did before the days with Quincy.
At the time, when Frank was playing Vegas, black people weren't allowed in the casinos. They'd play on stage and then have to go out the back. They'd have to stay in the crappy motels across town. When Frank found out, he was pissed. He pulled some strings and put a stop to that. Quincy's story is really the story of Black America. He had to deal with racism all the time. He was the first Black film composer. He had to break that barrier. He says he went to Paris to learn how to play strings because orchestras in America didn't think Black people should play instruments like the violin. Do you think that it's gotten any better?
For racism? It's gotten better. We've come a long way, but we've got a long way to go, honey. And, you know, it's just showing its face now. Because in the South, it was always very obvious what was going on. You knew where you stood, white and colored, drinking fountains, bus stations, hotels, everything. But in the North, it's all disguise and camouflage and everything else, you know. But my antenna's always on.
Yeah.
You can't help it. And Ray Charles and I used to say every day, not one drop of my self-worth depends on your acceptance of me. We had to, just, you know, to stay strong and survive. Boy, this country don't play.
Quincy worked and worked. He never stopped. But then he had 2 brain aneurysms in the 1970s, and he almost died. At that time, he was married to Peggy Lipton, the blonde star of the TV show The Mod Squad, and Rashida's mom.
What was your year, 76?
I'm 76, but you had those 74. The aneurysms were 74.
I was 75.
Born, oh, 75, right.
75. Kidal was born in 74.
Right.
Aneurysm, you were born in 76.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
So straighten it up.
Yeah. You know, I definitely struggled with whether or not I should include those, just because I felt protective and they're vulnerable moments. And it is certainly part of a story over and over and over again. I mean, the sheer will to survive is really, really evident. You know, I mean, it is a part of who he is, and it is a part of how he recalibrates and moves forward with his life. So it was something we absolutely had to include.
The movie's thesis for your health problems or those aneurysms was that you were just working too hard.
Yeah. Were you working too hard? Huh? Were you working too hard?
No, that wasn't it.
See, he still won't admit it.
Indulging is what got me in trouble.
Indulging in?
Because, yeah, you know, we were beboppers. We came up with every kind of dope you can think of.
So, like, what were you indulging
in? I came up with Ray Charles when I was 14. Ray was on heroin 30 years, you know. Yeah. And one of the greatest talents and human beings I've ever met. And that's what Nadia Boulanger, my teacher in Paris, always used to say to me. Your music can never be more or less than you are as a human being.
Quincy had to have two brain operations, and his doctor told him he could never again play the trumpet or any brass instrument. He says that was a huge disappointment. He has his trumpet mounted on the wall. Another disappointment, his three failed marriages. But his relationship with his seven children, at least how it's portrayed in the movie, is strong. How was it with you growing up? Did you see much of your dad?
I did, yeah.
We spent a lot of time together.
Yeah, we did.
We traveled, no matter working or not. I dragged them all over the world.
Your mom in the movie says that the work came in between the relationship.
Yeah, that happens.
Yeah.
A lot.
But there is, you know, it is this weird thing where I know that some people have dads that are there every day. They get home from school and they're there and they all have dinner together. That's just not, wasn't my life, but I don't feel deprived of love. You know, I feel like the quality of love that I got. Yeah, we hang, and we hang
for
now,
days,
you know, and
days.
We're friends. I think I know that sharing him with the world is part of the deal. It's part of what makes him great. It's part of what makes our relationship great. It's part of what makes him tick. And that's something I think a lot of people will feel if they do, you know, if they're in the position where they do have to share their parent with the world.
So she's sharing her parent with the world again, on her terms this time, in her new documentary. It's called Quincy, and you can see it on Netflix. Coming up, we'll listen back to my interview with two up-and-coming artists. Female rappers trying to make it in the male-dominated hip-hop world. That's next on Press Play. This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. The odds of becoming a rap star are like, what, 1 in 1 million or 50 million? Well, they are stacked against you even more if you're a female rapper because, well, hip-hop is dominated by men. There have always been women trying to make it in the rap game, of course. Like my next guest, Gavlin. She grew up in the San Fernando Valley. You know what's good. Come on and hit me where it hurts because I know they could. And I got so much to lose, but my feelings ain't a factor. Changing every second when I hit the next chapter. And Reverie, who grew up in Highland Park. Boy, bye, you ain't need a lie. And if they ask me about you, don't get denied. Please don't call me it. To say, cause I'm a boss. Now I'm playing no games. Boy, bye. Reverie and Gavlin came up in LA's underground hip hop scene. And they have, for the last decade or so, put out a steady stream of songs and mixtapes. When they came by our studios, I began by asking Gavlin to describe LA's hip hop scene.
It's expanded a lot. I would say, like, the underground LA rap scene has just like grown so much since what, like 06? I started to hop on at like 08, you know? Mm-hmm. It's been expanding a lot. I guess it's just female rap has been expanding a lot too.
Yeah.
It's been growing. It's
and
really
so
dope.
So, female
to see.
Rap itself, when did that start getting bigger?
I would only say during like the last since Nicki Minaj came out, basically.
Really? Yeah.
So I honestly, like, I'm a big Nicki Minaj fan, but especially of her as a businesswoman, as an entrepreneur, like, mm-hmm. as a woman in the male dominated industry. You cannot deny what she has done for hip hop, you know. And because back since before her, like, there's always only been like 1-2 females on the top, and like, they beefed it, you know what I mean?
Always.
And now it's different. Now these last 5 years or so have been really, like, women are finally starting to really unite with each other, and mm-hmm. and the public is not making us beef, you know what mm-hmm. I mean? Because that's a lot of people have tried to start things between me and Gavlin, or me and whoever, and, you know, other female rappers, and it's ridiculous, you know what I mean? I'm not gonna feed into that, but for so long that was what people were excited about.
But
so,
isn't that also what rap is?
Yeah. Like, yeah, totally. Rap is definitely like a competitive sport for
yeah,
sure.
Yeah.
But I think it's been more playful amongst dudes with each other. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? It's uh-huh. like, I mean, dudes have beef down the line, but it's always been like Foxy Brown or Lil' Kim. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? Or MC Light or Lauryn Hill mm-hmm. or Cardi B or Nicki Minaj. And it's like, now it's like, we're actually supporting each other, so
yeah.
I always thought those
were orchestrated just to juice up record sales.
I mean, we never know. It very well could be, you know what I mean? Like, yeah. For sure, that's an option.
Yeah,
totally.
Okay, so Gavlin, you were saying you hopped on, to use your lingo, in 08, so 10 years ago.
Yeah.
10 years ago, you yeah. first started doing this.
Yeah.
So what got you into it? How did you start?
Well, since I was a kid, I was always obsessed with being on stage. Like, even in elementary, I was like in every talent show, whether if I was doing Old MacDonald Had a Farm or Dancing to Aaliyah, you know, I was always obsessed with it. But I kind of jumped in very spontaneously, because I got into like underground hip hop, like growing up at like 15 years old. And then some of my boys were just freestyling. I literally just jumped in just to play around, you know, like it wasn't like a serious thing. But then I was like, wait, this is actually pretty cool. And I started to dig deeper. I started out with spoken word, and then I just applied my poetry to beats. And it was just history ever since.
And do you also write the music as well?
Oh, no. I would just write the raps.
that's enough.
Yeah.
So this was in the Valley, right? You grew up in San Fernando Valley?
Yeah, I grew up in the San Fernando Valley.
Yeah.
I didn't get down to L.A. till I was like 18.
Uh-huh. I mean, do you see it as two different worlds?
Totally.
Really?
Yeah.
How so?
The Valley has nothing for creatives at all. Like, unless you want to go to your local house party. It's like the suburbs of LA, I feel like. Unless you go to North Hollywood. That's actually where I did my first open mic. But yeah, if I didn't get out of the Valley, I wouldn't have been able to expand.
Yeah. And so where are you now? Where are you based now?
I'm in downtown LA, right okay. in the melting pot.
Wow. That is where it's happening.
We're neighbors now.
Yeah, we're neighbors now.
How did you two meet?
Rap music?
Yeah.
We met at the Cypher Effect, our first, that was our first girl Cypher.
But you know what? I actually saw Gavlin perform one time before that, though, at the Airliner. I saw you perform at the Airliner downstairs
right.
at that Urban Underground show,
yep.
I think it was called then.
Yep.
And then I think that was before I had ever even performed at a hip-hop show, to be honest with you, but we saw you. I don't remember who I was with. And we saw you. We're like, dang, that girl's dope. Who is she?
Hey.
And then that's when, then I think I heard your music on MySpace too, actually. I heard your music on MySpace and I liked it.
Hey,
especially,
cool.
I think my favorite song was like the one that the beat was like, if you see me walking.
That was like one of my first rap songs.
Yeah, I used to love
that's
that
awesome.
One.
Look the other way, don't pay no mind to me, cause I'm walking down the street headed to the bus stop, just pulled out the
and then I think the first time we met in real life was at the Cypher Effect.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I don't know, it's honestly, it's been a long time, so it's hard to remember now. Like,
and
that's
explain
was like
what the Cypher Effect
ago?
Is
the Cypher Effect the uh-huh. Cypher Effect is a hip-hop platform, this organization who throws shows internationally all around the world, and who has rappers from all over the world on their YouTube channel. And they have this thing that they do on their YouTube, and it's basically rappers that get in a cypher, and it's called the Cypher Effect. And usually the cyphers are themed, like if they go to like Mexico, they'll make like a cypher with Mexican rappers, or like if they're in LA, they'll make like a cypher with the best LA rappers. And they like to also mix things up, you know, they do a lot of really cool collaborations with people. So the Cypher Effect featured an all-female cypher, which is where me and Gavlin met and did our first thing together. And That's a Cypher Effect.
Wow.
Yeah,
okay,
really
that's
dope.
Cool. So, all right, Reverie, I need your origin story too. Mm-hmm. So, how did you first start rapping?
I guess when I was young, I wrote a lot of poetry. I wrote a lot of short stories, and I drew like a lot of stuff. Like, and I started writing raps in the junior high when I discovered underground hip hop. So up until then, I was obsessed with hip hop. I was listening to Power 106 every day. Like, I was like 5 years old, 7 years old. Like, I remember being that little, listening to Big Boy, like just Big Boy in the Morning, you know. And I was obsessed. And but then when I got into junior high, I was introduced to MERS and Immortal Technique, and that was the first time that it, I guess, occurred to me that people that aren't on the radio rap too. You know, I was a kid. I was like 12 or something, and then I recorded my first track when I was a senior in high school. And then I dropped my first mixtape in 2009. My first mixtape was called Castle in the Air.
I like it rough, I've smoked enough sticks, rocks, and stones. It breaks the skin, my gums are swollen, I'm rolling. Time to leave and I'm going. I left before you even noticed, and I'm not coming back. I'm pretty sure that's what you were hoping. Lone Star, I'm all
alone. When I started rapping, around my neighborhood, my name was already buzzing because I used to do a lot of graffiti, and like I was crazy, I was known around my neighborhood. And so I already had like my name buzzing.
You graffiti
getting...
by yourself?
Oh yeah, I graffitied by myself all the time. But
she
I would usually
like pictures
go
of her like on freaking like billboards, just like
really,
you know, trying to, yeah, just to not fall off that
as
thing.
A teenager.
Yeah, I was crazy. I was like bombing trains. I was doing, you know, the freeway overpasses when you're on the freeway.
Yeah,
I've done those like several times. I've like ran across the freeways to do it. I used to get in fights over it. I got kicked out of school for it. I would do all that stuff. Like, it was like the LA culture, you know, like I was super involved. I was involved with the gang. Like, my life was crazy growing up. My brothers were in and out of juvenile hall, and I was on hard drugs. Like, I started doing meth like at 15. Like, yeah, it was crazy. I had a crazy childhood. And
where is this?
This is in Highland Park.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And my mom, like, my mom, she was a good woman. She worked hard every day, and we had a house, you know, in a little nice pocket. But, like, we just got involved with the wrong people. And it's, like, in L.A., there's little tiny little nice pockets, but right down the street there's a trap house, you know. And I went to the public school in high school, and, like, it just, everything just went crazy. But my music was, like, my therapy. It was always, like, my little escape, you know. So, long story short, I was buzzing in the streets, started rapping. And so people were already talking about my name because of the graffiti. And then when I started rapping, everyone was like, oh, wow, she raps too now. You know, like, now it was like,
we love her.
Yeah. So that's how it started. That's really how it started. And that was back in 2008.
So same.
Mm-hmm.
So you've been doing this for 10 years.
Yeah. I know, I realized that the
that's
other day.
That's a long time.
That's crazy.
Yeah,
so how was it in 2008 being young women doing this in a,
intimidating.
In a pretty male world?
Very intimidating.
I mean, it's still a male world.
Yeah. Yes.
Especially like around that time in like the melting pot of LA hip hop, it was booming. Like, you know, like to be really good with words. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. It was pretty intimidating, but gave me thick skin.
Okay, let's hear "We On" by Gavilan.
Oh yes,
produced by DJ Hoppa.
Hoppa, dang! I just got to throw this out there, but this is one of my favorite songs of yours for sure. Like, I've heard this song a million times.
You know this, we taking over anything that's bogus. We focus, we smoke that power and say me. All I gotta do is keep it G, right. Squatch, grind it consistently, yeah. Not trying to settle for the robbery. We got a policy, nothing but quality. Ayo, we on, piece of those that say we not. Ayo, we on.
And We On, actually, that was produced by my big bro, DJ Hoppa.
Like, literally your big brother?
Basically. I've known him since I was like 16. He came out with the hook. He was like, I hear like, yo, we on. That's all he was saying, yo, we on. And I was like, okay. And then, you know, started to add to it. But it was super spontaneous because of that album. We took it track by track. You know what I mean? Normally, like a couple years ago, I would do a whole, like I would lock myself in a room and just do a whole album and then be like, hey, world, I'm here with an album. And that didn't really work. Everybody was like, oh, we thought you were dead or something, you know? So.
Right, because people want singles
now.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Reverie, let's talk about Critique Like Me.
Oh, yeah.
Let's hear that.
Critique my creativity. I'ma be me. Put famous overseas. I'ma be me. You stay wasting time, but I'ma be me. Hating cause I shine, but I'ma be me. You be talking like you got credibility. Try so hard to be me, they can never be you. You can't deny that cause it's true. I paid the price to walk in these shoes. No one understands me.
So you say there that you're famous overseas.
Yes.
And you are more famous overseas than you are here?
I would say yes, but only because when people ask me this, I always have to say this whole answer. The thing is that in Europe, I think I've toured in like 12 countries right there or something like that. 10 or 12 countries. Somehow, how many countries have we been in there? 10 or 12 at least, right?
Yeah, girl, I lost count.
Yeah. But the thing is that over there, some of their countries are the sizes of our states.
Yeah.
The United States is humongous, like if you compare the land. So,
but
as
when you
a,
go to show, when you play shows there, describe the audience.
Sometimes, like, for example, I think our last show in Berlin was 350 people. Mm-hmm. And then we perform at festivals with thousands and thousands of people, too, you know?
What is it like for you playing over there?
That's crazy. Europe, like, broke me out of everything. Like, it really showed me that the internet's real.
Yeah.
But, yeah, and I definitely have a bigger fan base in Europe than I do America. It's growing more and more in the States. But Europe's been, like, a culture shock in so many good ways. I think they have different appreciation. Like, for example, France, they're so hardcore, you know? Like, if they will boo you if you're whack, you know?
Really?
Yeah. They're super about it. But it's cool because they just represent, you know? They're so, like, about that life. Yeah. It's really cool.
Je t'aime. Je t'aime, France. Mm-hmm. Bonjour.
So do you have representation? How does this work? Because here you are, you sort of kind of did it on your own, right?
Like, yeah.
Yes. Serious DIY.
Yeah.
Serious.
So how does it work when you want to tour Europe and you want to, I guess, get bigger? I don't know.
Right. I mean, shout out to our girl, Rita G. Bookins. She's the whole reason for all of that.
Hell yeah.
Totally. She's bringing us out there. It's an everyday
thing.
Is
she a manager?
She's our booking agent.
Your booking agent. Okay.
Yeah.
In international.
For booking agent slash homegirl slash sister. We love that girl.
Yeah, she's dope.
Yeah. But I mean, it's crazy because we're so independent. Everything is so like we do ourselves. So it's like, you never know. It's like we got to just keep putting in that work to see what's going to happen the next day.
Yeah.
It's so unpredictable, you know?
Yeah, it's crazy, like, having so many things on our plates. People don't even think about the fact that we're doing all of these things ourselves.
Yeah.
They think it's just
it's
easy.
It's like a business. People think they're just sitting there writing and performing and that's it.
Yeah, like, when I go on tour, like, we're taking trains at 5 in the morning. We're going directly to the airport after a show, after we perform at 12 o'clock. We get out of the show at 3 o'clock after meeting everybody and performing and signing autographs. And then we catch a flight 2 hours later. We don't even, like, I take a shower.
Get straight to the venue.
Yeah, like, it's crazy. Like, this is not, like, this simple, easy life. Like, it's very draining physically, emotionally, mentally, and you have to be really, really strong to do this. Yeah.
So, in a way, do you want to be where you are? And I mean, in underground rap, or do you actually envision yourselves as the goal, like being Cardi B? Is that something that you
always
want?
Striving for something bigger? Always, you know. But as long as it's conducted to our identities. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, respect to Cardi B. The coolest thing about her is she's her own person. She didn't try to be like anybody else.
Shout
you know,
out to
like
Cardi.
That's what I love most about her. She doesn't care. Hell She'll let you know like the most off the wall type of things. But that's why people love her. It's like that's definitely somebody I would inspire to. Like when it comes to how she just identifies with herself, for sure. I think we definitely want bigger things in our life. That's what we're working towards to every day. But definitely do want to be able to, you know, have our own identities and make, you know, like Reverie's Reverie, Gavlin's Gavlin. Like, you'll know who we are. We're not going to sound like this or sound like that. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
But yeah, definitely.
Yeah, I totally agree. I'm going to go all the way to the top. We're going to be winning awards and winning all kinds of stuff. That's definitely the goal. Yeah,
absolutely.
Okay, I want to play a song that you appeared on together.
Yes.
With another woman named Belle the Wonder.
Yes.
Uh-huh.
Yes.
This one is called Looking Back.
Let's do it.
I'm gonna make them scream my name at the show. Throw my own events and direct my own videos. I'm a blow.
I'm a blow.
It's crazy reminiscing. I reflect on my past to feel better about the present. Looking back. You wonder way back where it's at. Spitting off this rat. Looking back. You wonder way back where it's at. From the front to the back. So what it be like, 15 with a rap dream. Trying to break down schemes that's flowing in my bloodstream. I know just what they mean and how they make me feel. And I'm not mad at how they mold me. Honestly, I never felt my will. So where they at though, put you for hands high. And light one for you and I, no I cannot lie. 5 years ago, all we did was try. And we out here, hungry in the grind. Never die, still alive.
yo, we never quitting. Yeah. We stay living, do the most if it lane different. I ain't tripping, love the moment that I am breathing. We steady moving, don't see the purpose in any sleeping. We keep on pushing, keep it feeling, come on. Doing what I love and see the aftermath. Running through these chapters a little too fast. Right, they say no one's safe, but I'm built to last. Y'all scratching the surface, but yo, I'm breaking glass.
Okay, I love that line. Y'all scratching the surface, but I'm breaking the glass.
Yay!
That's really great.
Thank you.
I'm assuming you're talking about the glass ceiling as well.
Yeah.
Right?
Yep.
And you're talking about being women working together and
breaking those barriers
and making it.
Totally.
And that you're all doing it together and you're not having this kind of rivalry.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, shout out to Hoppa on the beat.
Yeah, and shout out Hop.
Actually, we filmed a music video for it, as you probably know, and it hit over a million views, right? It's a million, right?
It broke a million.
Yeah, I'm like, I can't even think, because we've been having so many videos hitting a million. It's crazy.
Yeah, that song was long overdue for the three of us. It was really cool.
That's really cool. All right, where can people hear more of your music?
I'm everywhere. Wherever you listen to music, I'm there. Yeah. Tidal, Apple Music, Spotify, SoundCloud, anywhere. We just Google. You can Google me. I'm everywhere.
Google Reverie.
Same here. I'm on
Google
Apple Music, Spotify, YouTube. You can type my name in Google too. We'll probably have pictures together. Like, hey,
yeah, you know? We for sure will.
Well, I want to thank you both so much for coming in today.
Thank you so much for having us.
Thank you.
But the haters silent nowadays because they respect us. Yeah, we queens in this. Finesse like it's nothing. I mean, we really in this.
That's right, bitch.
Looking back, go all the way back where it's at. Spitting off this rap. Looking back, go all the way back where it's at. From the front to the back. Looking back.
That's Gavlin and Reverie. And that's it for our special New Year's Eve edition of Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. Happy New Year.
From the front to the back.
The sun dropped down, driving up Vermont. What now? Almost time to wrap it up on top. Hunt, how did this even happen? Not long ago, I was.